and welcome to episode 57 of Attention Please with Arnab Ray right here on Talking Stuff Network. We have an extremely fun episode ahead of us today and where your host would be answering all your questions. But before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to thank our network sponsor, Sleep Spa from CoirFit. My favorite mattress of theirs is the very aptly named Nirvana. It's made of 100% organic latex and it's natural bamboo fabric. It uses a chemical-free process which makes it dust mite resistant, environment friendly, and most importantly, biodegradable. Did I mention that it's insanely comfortable too? These guys, they're so confident about that mattress that they offer 11-year warranty and also 100 nights trial. No kidding. So this festive season, why don't you gift yourself or a loved one back in India the gift of great sleep and relief from backaches? Order a mattress from sleepspa.in, that's sleepspa.in, and you can use the coupon code TALKINGSTUFF15 and get 15% off. That should add the sweet dreams to your good night. We thank Sleep Spa for their support. And now, on with the podcast. I don't have an opening question for Arnab because we've got loads of them coming in from you even right now. So let me get your host right in. Hey, Arnab.
Hello.
All set. You've got a barrage of questions for you. Farrago, sure. If I'm using the term right.
Yes. So please ask them in any random order.
Okay. The first one, of course, seems to be the most popular question and with good reason too, because your alma mater is again in the news for the wrong reasons, if I may say so. So we've got Anand, Mayuresh, Samarpan Datta and Subro and a few others writing in and asking your view on the Jadavpur University incident and asking if BJP can ever hope to capture power in West Bengal or Bangla, as it might soon be called.
So, first of all, when I was a student in Jadavpur University, there was no ABVP there at all. So the fact that there is a BJP presence in Jadavpur University is for me startling, surprising, and something which I personally could not have predicted as a student there in the mid-90s. Because Jadavpur University was essentially every shade of left, where SFI was the most right-wing organization in the campus. And I'm not kidding, it actually was.
SFI is the Congress-backed one?
No, it is the CPM-backed one.
Oh, good. Man, okay.
So that's the Student Federation of India. They were usually the most right-wing. To the left of them was DSF. I've forgotten what the full form for that was. And by the way, I'm talking about engineering. I think it was similar in arts. And then there was another union. It was another, again, students organization called... I'm tempted to say RSA, but I'm pretty sure this is my cybersecurity... my cybersecurity future kind of writing itself on my Jadavpur past. So I don't think it was RSA. It was something else, but sounded, was it RSP? I don't know. It's not RSP because RSP is a party, Revolutionary Socialist Party. But there were three of these political dadas. And they were all pretty useless, actually, of course. Because first of all, you have to understand that when we were growing up, Jadavpur University was... Despite what Jadavpur University students like to write on social media, Jadavpur University was not, but many people actually think outside, was Jadavpur University is a very political campus. It was one of the least political campuses in Calcutta. Because most people there, engineering was like the 800-pound gorilla, just didn't care about politics. They were mostly studying for GRE and GATE. So politics, and again, I can say that, as being a student at Jadavpur University, nobody took the student union seriously. They would make fun of them mostly. And even the times that we kind of walked in the Michils was because in a kind of a half mocking way that, class nahi karna hai, so let's just go and stand. And none of us took any of this seriously at all. So I remember there was this time when they took us out and they started, so there is this Shidhu and Kanu and all these leaders of the Santal rebellion. So the dada said, we will walk and say, Shidhu bol, Kanu bol, Hamla bol. So this is like, so I remember we started saying Sidhu bol, Azhar bol, Kambli bol, because, Sidhu. So there was never this visceral political soul in Jadavpur University Engineering. There just wasn't. I think the things have changed. Of course, they might have changed with social media and with the whole centrifuge effect. I'm pretty sure that the student population there too has been radicalized. And in this case, I would say radicalized on both sides. With respect to the specific incident, for those of you who've been following the story, the person who was accused of having manhandled Babul Supriyo is actually not from Jadavpur University at all. He's a student from outside. So it was, which makes sense because, as I said, nobody in Jadavpur University would actually go there. They wouldn't be so foolhardy as to go and touch the collar of an union minister because ultimately they have to get placed in TCS, right? And so there's just a line. They would perhaps, you know, stand 5 feet away and say, you know, fascist, go back. But that the last 5 feet, they won't go there. Most people won't go there because everybody is well aware of the future that lies in front of them. And the fact that, especially in this day of social media, the internet does not forget, just like the Lannisters. So, sorry, the North does not forget. I'm already forgetting. The Lannisters pay their debt and the North never forgets. So, for me, I was surprised that, even the supposed goons of the ABVP that came there all from outside, which again makes sense. I don't think that ABVP would normally have a foothold within Jadavpur University, but over the years, Jadavpur University politics has primarily been local. It has never, at least when I was there, it was never really on the big issues. It was never really about fascism, maybe because there was no fascism in those days. Congress ruled and everybody was happy with them. But mostly Jadavpur University politics was about local issues, like, you know, the library fine can't go up by 5 paise, that kind of thing. Or, you know, few students in mechanical engineering failed their second year or something and they got supplementary exams and the questions came from out of syllabus. And the professor apparently said that in mechanical engineering, nothing can be out of syllabus because once you know Newton's third laws, apparently everything can be deduced from it. So, you know, those were the reasons. And they were, and of course, they were very close to your heart. Like when you fail in an exam, of course, that's pretty much as real can be. So politics in Jadavpur University, at least at that point of time, was all about the immediate. And it was mostly with respect to the Jadavpur University educational bureaucracy, the vice chancellor, the EC. So it was mostly about people going and gheraoing the vice chancellor. I think I'd mentioned this once before in my podcast that once that this actually happened, people went and, you know, gave a deputation to the vice chancellor as to why Vinod Kambli has, why Saurav Ganguly has been dropped in Toronto. And this is, and again, this was the level of politics, and people did that as a like kind of spoof the other things. But there was a healthy amount of self awareness. At least it was never ugly. I, at least growing, you know, in the four years that I spent, I've never seen campus violence. I've never seen people, you know, really fighting at all. It was all very genial, even college campus elections, and that was not the case in other universities in Calcutta, by the way. I mean, the other universities were like hotbeds of political intrigue and violence. But Jadavpur University was a totally different beast. And so, and again, this is a long time ago. So obviously things have changed now. With this, I see that, I mean, I just can't see how ABVP is going to have a significant presence in Jadavpur University until and unless they bring in people from outside. It just doesn't work. And most people are, of course, leftists. And in a way, I think that, especially in it has a strong liberal arts section, I think that it's very natural that there would be more leftism than rightism in an university like that. In general, like all other places, the right to kind of came from the engineering section, but most people were too intimidated to say it, at least at that point of time. Whoever had leaked the slightest right-wing inclinations in those days would not self-associate, because of, you know, people like to say it was all friendly because, as I said, SFI was the most right-wing. So everybody was left, like different shades of left. Some were red, some were maroon, some were very heavy pink, but they were all like different shades of red. So if somebody came and it was at least a tinge of orange, then that person might stand out. And that might trigger violence. So I think that never happened. And so what we see now, again, I think the recent fiasco at Jadavpur University can be interpreted as, again, as Amit Shah and BJP aggressively trying to take the battle into the opponent's turf. Now, this is a little strange because Jadavpur University isn't also Trinamool Congress territory, by the way. This is not a place where Mamata Banerjee also is well respected. Of course, she's more respected than, of course, the quote-unquote fascists. But it's not a place where even she has a lot of influence inside the Jadavpur University campus. It is mostly an isolated leftist haven that it always has been. But now, as I see that there is at least an ABVP union, I understand that there is now some trouble in leftist paradise, which doesn't exist because leftists don't believe in paradise. But the closest they could get to heaven would be Jadavpur University. So I can kind of see that, you know, Eve has eaten the apple and things are changing. That is all I can say. And I'll stop there since we have other questions to answer.
Okay. The next one, I'm not sure if you caught the episode of KBC or know what this is about. This is about Sonakshi's gaffe. Are you aware of what happened?
I am aware of what happened.
You, of course, are. So the question is from Shravan, and he asks that the so-called Bollywood elite have come up instantly to defend Sonakshi. Would this have happened if her father was still in BJP?
I think it would have happened. I think the first thing that you have to understand is that Bollywood, by its very nature, it's a very close-knit community. And they cover their own secrets and they look out for their own people. So everybody backs everybody. You'll see, I mean, of course, this is on the surface only. I'm sure that the daggers are out and people like bitch and crib about each other all the time. But if you look at any movie which comes out, you'll find no Bollywood celebrity giving a bad review or saying anything moderately negative about another movie. It hardly ever happens. The only place where you might hear this is on Karan Johar's show during the rapid fire round, and somebody would say, oh, I found Barfi to be a little, I think I heard that once, I found Barfi to be overhyped. I mean, this is the most trenchant criticism of Bollywood you would get from one Bollywood person. And again, this is for a movie. It is not for a particular person. Of course, Karan Johar tries to poke, and you know, there's been some, but again, much of Karan Johar's show is also manufactured reality, like most other reality shows. So you should always take it with a pinch of salt. But however, ultimately, everybody will support everybody, especially somebody like Sonakshi Sinha's. I don't think the BJP is a particularly a problem. It would have been a problem with, the thing is that even if Shatrughan Sinha had been in the BJP, he was always it's not that BJP wasn't accepted in Bollywood ever. Bollywood is very accepting of everything because ultimately it's a money-making machine. So it cannot really be against anyone. So that's why I don't think Bollywood, the only thing I would say is that they're at Bollywood now, perhaps. And again, this doesn't affect Shatrughan Sinha, who's part of old Bollywood. But Bollywood now has become much more political. Because the reason why they're political is simple. There are a few people who don't really fit into the old Bollywood system, the Anurag Kashyaps. And so they have become political because they want to be like George Clooney. Because they don't look towards the Manmohan Desais to take their cues. They look westwards. And so they want that kind of, they want to pretend. Or I mean, ultimately, all of us want to live in some kind of fantasy, right? You know, when life isn't about making, you know, money every day and coming home and seeing your bank balance, you're too rich for that. Then you have to live in some kind of fantasy. So these people live in that fantasy world where they look at the mirror and they see George Clooney or Meryl Streep or someone. So they, of course, since they are against Trump and fascism, these guys are against fascism. But again, it's more or less an abstract idea. It's mostly they see the faces of Modi and Amit Shah. They wouldn't really see Shatrughan Sinha there, even if he was not out of favor with the party. Because he's ultimately a friend. He's ultimately part of that social circle. And, you know, Shatrughan Sinha is as Bollywood can be in every respect, in every sense of the term.
All right. And the next one, of course, is something which is buzzing all over town. That's about Howdy Modi. And I saw that somebody even asked you on Twitter whether you're attending the event in Dallas. So just to clarify, you are not in Dallas right now, are you?
No, I'm not.
So Siddhesh asks us whether it's a smart move by Trump to associate himself with Modi for the Howdy Modi event. And if I can extend, the Democrats seem to have kept the arm's length away from Modi during, except probably Tulsi Gabbard, who realistically doesn't have a chance.
Hardly a Democrat anymore.
Oh, okay. So anyway, your thoughts.
So the thing is that, see, Trump is, it's all about him. So Trump, Trump is going to meet Pakistan. So, you know, right after this. So under Trump, there's from at a very high level, Pakistan and India have again become hyphenated. So anything that's done to India will have to be replicated to Pakistan. Now with Trump, he does not work like any other US president. So for him, first of all, I hope that Trump is given the importance that he believes he deserves. So he doesn't like to play second fiddle to anyone. So if he's on the stage, it has to be Howdy Trump too. Otherwise he's going to, you know, basically tear up the background.
Both Modi and Trump don't like to share the spotlight. I wonder
both
how that will play
and
out.
Trump don't like to share the spotlight, but Trump is, so there's a difference between Modi and Trump. First of all, Modi didn't grow up the way Trump did. So Modi loves the spotlight and he loves the cameras, but it's on a different, but Trump's is on a different level. Because for Trump, it is his birthright. He has had it ever since he was born because of how rich his dad was. So he believes that it's his birthright. And this belief is not something, it's not something which is, it's so much a part of who he is. And all of us, when we grow up, we kind of come up with these beliefs. We all have these beliefs which are like kind of hard-coded into us, to use a software engineering analogy. We deserve this treatment. And that is a function of the social context in which we grew up in. And for Trump, this kind of fawning is something which he's always grown up like a king. So this kind of fawning is not something which he believes is special. He believes that is the baseline for living. So I don't know how he's going to even, I don't even know how the program is organized and whether this is ultimately going to be good for India-US relationship or not. Because I honestly don't feel that having those two there makes things any better for any of them. Having said that, I don't think that you should read this too much into as Modi favoring India over Pakistan, because I don't think that is the case at all. Trump lives in the moment. So he will favor the last person who has bent his knee and has said, sir, you're great. And if that's Imran Khan, he will be kind to Imran Khan. So ultimately, I don't think that there is any long-term foreign affairs or any kind of coming together. Because ultimately, if you look at Trump's policies have been terrible towards Indians in terms of legal immigration. As I've been repeatedly telling you, that even though the illegal immigration is really is kind of the red meat, but the real thing with Steve Bannon is he wants to stop legal immigration of people like software engineers. That's the real problem, because that is the alt-right, the white nationalist base is actually, they're all out-of-work programmers. That's really who they are. And for them, Indians and Chinese are their biggest problem. So, and Trump's government has been working at, you know, kind of cutting away at legal immigration in every way. And so illegal immigration, yes, but also Trump and his friends know that the American economy depends on illegal immigration. Because if you actually stopped illegal immigration, then there'll be nobody to do agricultural labor. There would be nobody to work at minimum wage in Trump's own resorts. That would just go away. So in a way, the American economy subsists on the fact that people are illegal, that they cannot claim the rights because they're afraid, because they don't have legal papers, that they cannot claim the rights that are given to American workers. So to an extent, they will do this to get votes and to get the base excited, but they, all of them know where the line is and they will not cross that line. With legal immigration, with Indians, there is no such line. Because the Indians are not a significant vote bank. They neither, they, and for some reason, I mean, the Indian diaspora here has been more, they're basically, it's very different from the Jewish diaspora, which actually wants to influence foreign policy. And one thing is that they are richer, they're more, and they've been here for a long time. But for the, you know, the Hindu NRI community, which again is coming into, will be in very much in prominence tomorrow. For them, it's mostly getting a photo taken with Trump or with Modi. That's really their depth of their engagement. If they get their photo taken, they will pay $300 for a dinner. That's it. So that's the kind of engagement that they want. They don't want like a Koch brothers kind of engagement where you have, you know, millionaires sponsoring groups who for years and years and years keep hammering away at the gates of power to get their agenda in. That is not for us. There's nobody here who's willing to undertake, I mean, forget the Koch brothers, but even something which is lesser than that. There are a lot of these initiatives that have been in Washington, D.C., where people create think tanks. They create think tanks. They create, you know, how is policy actually influenced in D.C.? It's actually influenced by, quote unquote, educating, which is where the lobbyists actually work. The advisors and the sub-advisors of the different congressmen. The congressmen basically are told by people, hey, so the data that they get from their, you know, they get from their staff. So if you want to influence the senator, you don't go to the senator. I mean, of course, you can go to the senator and, you know, pay for his campaign. But the more long-term thing is you basically train his staff. You train his staff to tell him or her what you want him or her to hear. So influence in DC basically works at level 2 and level 3, not at level 1. Most Indian efforts are at level 1. It is really at level 2 and level 3, which happens through an intricate, you know, network of NGOs and think tanks that actually influence. And it, of course, doesn't happen in a year or 2 years or 5 years or even 10 years. It happens over generations. It happens over generations till you reach the kind of relationship that, for instance, US has with Israel. And we've never cultivated that. We've never cultivated that. So, you know, this, we will have events like this, but that doesn't imply anything deeper than, you know, a few photo ops.
Okay. And coming back to Indian politics, our next question is from Anirudh Rao. And by the way, the next month, I think around this time, Maharashtra goes to polls, and this one is alludes to that. So Anirudh asks us, how can Congress or the other opposition actually become an effective opposition? And your thoughts on new Pappu in Maharashtra? I don't know who's the new Pappu in Maharashtra, by the way. Do you?
Yeah. I think this is Anjana Om Kashyap.
Okay.
You know, she, as far as I know, she was on a live mic or something, and she referred to Aditya Thackeray as the new Pappu. And then, of course, she realized the mistake of, you know, calling anybody with the last name of Thackeray anything other than the Supreme Lord and Commander. So then she apologized. And so again, I think the reason why she said that was he was coming across as, rather than Bal Thackeray's grandson, more AOC's, more from the school of AOC in terms of his, you know, aggressive environmentalism. It's not basically something which you associate with Shiv Sena. And I can understand that he wants to pivot Shiv Sena to be, you know, something else, you know, vastly different from what it was under his grandfather, and, you know, good luck to him. But coming back to the actual question as to what can the Congress do now, it's very difficult. This is like saying, you know, what can Zimbabwe do now that Masakadza has retired to defeat India? It's very difficult. You know, there's no but for I think overall the important thing is that the Congress and all other parties are really losing. It's not a question of, you know, 5% GDP growth. Ultimately, we discussed this before, nobody really votes based on numbers. They're based on perception. They base their perception on how they feel and what the government has done for them. And sometimes it may not even be like that, just be based on a person, its personality. The first thing is that Congress needs to have a personality you can go up against Modi. And as long as they tether their fortunes to the Gandhi family, they're not going to find that. There's nobody in the Gandhi family who can take on Modi. None of them. Neither Priyanka nor Rahul. I mean, they've been trying for years.
But it's just not going to be this. It's a beta tumse na ho paega situation at this point of time. And Robert Vadra wears pink trousers. So, you know, you cannot, I mean, none of the Gandhi family, and I think people inside the Congress party have understood that. They have been trying to make noise. They've been trying to get alternative leadership. But it's obvious that the kind of hold that Congress, that the family has over their purses means that that they're not going to put up. They're not going to put up anyone other than either somebody they can control, or one of their own blood. They have learned their lesson with Narasimha Rao as to what happens when you put up a really competent person in charge, because the competent person then doesn't want to let go. So they have learned their lesson. They have learned their lesson enough for this generation. So even though Rahul Gandhi and somebody else might want to give the reins to somebody else, Sonia Gandhi will never allow that, because she has lived through the Narasimha Rao days, when Narasimha Rao was this close to basically getting the Gandhis out of the Congress. So she will never allow that position. They will never allow that family to be put into that position. And unfortunately, that is the biggest impediment towards Congress winning. From a policy perspective, Congress has to pursue some variant of soft Hindutva. It has to. The needle is shifted to the right, unequivocally. And while people, and I think that most Indians are kind of centered right, in the sense that it's easy, actually, in that respect. All that the Congress has to do is, which is increasingly becomes BJP's weak point, is they have to say, look, we oppose violence. And I think that, and I've mentioned this in my podcast before, that while it is true that I don't think that new statistically we have more lynchings now than we used to, but the reaction of government to lynchings has been different. Yes, the press is on the government. The press is inimical to the government. That's all of that is true. In a large, but the government does have its own press now. It does have its own, you know, very, very obviously their own press. They have their Sarkari channels now. But the government just did not do enough in terms of communicating that it condemned. And the reason why they couldn't do it is because many of these people were ultimately their people. And this is true for every political party. Mamata Banerjee's her supporters go and bash up doctors. She doesn't condemn, she goes and condemns the doctor. So this is true for every political party, that ultimately they will always support their supporters. And BJP is no different. Congress is no different. We saw that in 1984. And Trinamool Congress is no different. You'd expect it to, you know, Kejriwal to have been any different. But when that Khirki extension thing happened with Somnath Bharti, he was no different. So ultimately, nobody is any different. So this is the only place where Congress can make a move, is to say, look, we will be different. We promise to be different. That we understand. So they have it in BJP's, where BJP does not want the battle to be. As long as Congress wants to play the game that is currently being played, it will lose every time. There's no one. It's like battling against Thanos. There's all the millions of possibilities all end with Modi winning, except this one, where they basically take Modi on their own turf with somebody who can go up against Modi, and that is not anybody from the Gandhi family. It has to be a Congress person, because I don't think that other than Congress there is any other national party. I mean, I know that Congress has been reduced to a rump of what it used to be, but it's the only party which still has the traction. It's the one that anybody will even consider seriously as a national party. I don't think there's any other party. Nobody outside the state of Bengal will consider Mamata Banerjee as a leader. Nobody outside the state of Uttar Pradesh will consider Mulayam Singh Yadav as a leader. So there's nobody. This is just a function, and I think this is same goes true for, you know, Tamil Nadu. Nobody will consider that somebody a national leader from there. The only person who can be a national leader has to come from the Congress. It can't be a Gandhi. So these are the two things that it needs to solve. First of all, and I don't think that these are solvable problems currently, given their constraints. One is they have to jettison the Gandhi fully and, you know, get somebody else. And second is they have to target the right. They have to move and become center-right. And they need to make a distinction. Third thing is they need to be politically right. I think economically right also. This is very difficult for Congress because the Modi government has been pretty much economically left. So economically right, slightly, whatever works in India, of course. In India, the messaging is always socialist, but somewhat of restricted government, somewhat of mode of divestment, and we haven't had that because nobody wants to get rid of, for instance, Air India, because it's a free meal ticket of every politician in India. So Congress has to do three things: get rid of the Gandhi family, two, go right, soft right, strongly condemn violence, and distinguish themselves as saying, we understand the concerns of Hindus, but you know, we want to draw a line that we shall not allow violence. We shall not allow this country to become like Pakistan. They have to make that. They have to make that argument. But you know, and it's something which Shashi Tharoor is trying to do. By the way, Shashi Tharoor has gotten. Shashi Tharoor is a smart guy, right? He's gotten it, and he's, if it's not obvious enough, he's pushing himself as the leader. By the way, so Shashi Tharoor has understood what it is. He's messaging it. Papu, Mr. Rahul Gandhi is too much of an idiot to even understand, you know, what's going on here. And more people ultimately will go to Shashi Tharoor's stand. Shashi Tharoor is trying to articulate an alternative to the Congress messaging, which is the only alternative which can work. I absolutely understand, and I absolutely understand. I think it's good what he's trying to do. This is the only way in which Congress can survive. It cannot survive the way it is. And third is it has to take the stance of limiting government and act upon it. I think if they can do these three things, I think there is a reasonable chance. Again, I don't think they'll ever do it, by the way, because they won't satisfy the condition number one. But it's very important, actually, for there to be a viable opposition in this country. This is not a good state for democracy when you have one country, one political party which has an outrageous election year, and then follows it up with an even more outrageous and overwhelming victory. So this is not good for democracy. In democracy, no matter what the other political party is, no matter whether you agree with them, or no matter how corrupt to the core the other opposition is, whatever it is, there has to be an opposition. There has to be democracy. Otherwise, democracy works best when it works slow, when you have a number of forces pushing in different directions. If you remember those physics problems in IIT physics, you know, you have multiple forces from different directions pulling, and then you calculate the resultant force. If all those other forces go away in just one direction, one force, then that is not good for a democracy, especially a democracy as diverse as India.
As unlikely as it is, what are the chances of, let's say, assimilating the breakaway factions? So getting Mamata or getting Sharad Pawar, since the BJP is even on their home turf, even they do have quite a bit to lose. So what about getting Congress back together?
Mamata Banerjee will never become part of Congress. That boat has sailed and vanished into the ocean. There is no way that Mamata Banerjee will, given her, and again, most political leaders are megalomaniacs, because I think it's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Politicians are megalomaniacs because that level of politics draws megalomaniacs. So you will find the best megalomaniacs going into politics. So it kind of winnows people out. And so Mamata Banerjee, the Mamata Banerjee of 1984, when Pranab Mukherjee would come and he would say Dada, and that Mamata Banerjee is gone, right? That Mamata Banerjee was a subservient Mamata Banerjee junior politician. Mamata Banerjee is not going to take any boss anymore. There's no boss. She is the boss. So I don't think that, it's like Jayalalitha. Could somebody like Jayalalitha ever join the Congress? No, of course not. Could somebody like Mulayam ever join the Congress? No. So Congress cannot draw these people in as part of Congress. They can only have alliances. And again, the moment they have alliances, these partners will try to whittle away it, because ultimately they are going to compete with Congress. Right now, nobody takes the Congress seriously at all. And why should Mamata Banerjee ally herself with Congress? I mean, Congress has more to gain from allying with her than she with Congress.
Fair enough. One more from Samarpan Datta, whose name I messed up earlier, so apologies about that. He asks whether your views on Kashmir, have they evolved over the last 45 days?
No. I don't evolve that fast.
Okay, that was fast. Okay, now this is probably my favorite question. It came in on WhatsApp. So with the writer didn't identify himself or herself. So please, when you do send in your WhatsApp messages, please ensure that you write in your name as well. And the question is, what dog would you get if you could, and how would you select it at a pound?
So, wow, my favorite topic. So again, I would, since I am a first time dog owner, I would possibly go for one of the smaller breeds. Most likely it would be some kind of poodle mix. So either a miniature poodle, or a golden doodle, or a Maltipoo, which is a cross between Maltese and poodle. So it would be a poodle with some other breed mixed in, or it would be a poodle. Basically a smaller dog, because you need a little bit more confidence dealing with larger dogs. So I do like large dogs, I don't think that I'm there yet. I take dog ownership very seriously. So like most things, but definitely dog ownership very seriously. So I wouldn't own a dog unless I'm 100% sure that I can handle the breed, and that the breed, because different breeds have, I think somebody wrote to me and said, that somebody she knew abandoned her dog because the dog had a lot of separation anxiety. So I said, was it a spaniel? She said, I don't know the breed, but I can find out. And then she found it and she said, you're right, it was a spaniel. So nowadays, if you just give me the behavior, I normally can tell you the breed just by that, because they're very individual. They're very distinctive breed behaviors. I think that, some kind of poodle mix would gel most with my lifestyle. And how do you select a dog at a pound? So there are a few things that you have to... First thing that you have to notice is, see, most people at most dogs at pounds are behind a cage. So if you're walking by and you see a dog that you like, the first thing that you should do is you should sit down on your haunches and come to their eye level. Because otherwise, look at the world from the dog's perspective. What he sees is a lumbering giant standing in front, okay, with the shadow falling on him. So this is intrinsically intimidating for the dog. So don't do that. Don't cast your shadow like that on the dog. Sit at his level so that he can look at you in a non-threatening way. Okay, there's a cage there, so he can't bite you. So the second thing is, don't get into a situation where, put your finger in. Don't do that at all, because that's his space. Do not do that. You have no idea where the dog has come from and what the dogs, and many people do that. I've seen them, they put the face, and some dogs are very nice, they'll lick your finger, but many dogs aren't like that. There's a reason why they have landed up there, and you have no idea as to what that reason is. The third thing, and the thing that I always notice, is what the position of their tail. So if they're basically wriggling their butt to the side, this side, that side, and the tail is going sideways, that's usually a sign that the dog is friendly, that the dog is, and even if the dog is barking, what it's actually saying is, please take me out, I want to go for a walk. And you have to understand that these dogs who require like a lot of exercise, like 2 hours exercise a day, sometimes get 15 minutes of walk time in 2 weeks, if at all that. So you have to understand that the amount of stress that each of these dogs are under. But even after that, if the dog is kind of wagging its tail from side to side, then you will understand the dog is friendly. If the tail is between the legs, that means the dog is scared or submissive. And you might think submissive and scared is good, but it's not. Because when they're scared and submissive, that's when they're submissive. Submissive basically means very scared of you right now, which could either lead to a bite later or could lead to what's known as submissive peeing. That is basically they pee whenever they see you, which is not a good thing if you bring them home. Okay. So don't go for, it's terrible to say don't go for a dog which is scared, but unless you are willing to put in that effort and you are ready to accept the risks of taking in a scared dog, don't take a scared dog. Because the worst thing you can do is take the dog to bring him home, see it doesn't work out, and throw him back there again. That is the worst thing you can do to that dog. So when you take that dog out and you decide to adopt, make sure that you're absolutely sure that you can keep him and you're ready to commit to that dog. Other things that you should watch to the tail is if the tail is straight, okay, or it's standing up, that means it's guarding. That means this is his space, don't get close. Now, this could be because the dog has been trained as a guard dog. So that's his natural reaction, that when he sees a stranger, he doesn't go up and say, let's play. So it's not that the dog is inherently unfriendly, but he's been trained to react like that. Which again, if you're looking for a guard dog, you might like that in a dog. But again, beware. For me, whenever I go and I see a dog whose tail is standing up or between the legs, I automatically know this dog is absolutely not. I mean, this dog needs a lot of work. But there's still many dogs who are very, very happy still. I don't know how they are, but they're very still happy. They're very trustful. They just want to come out to play. So do these three things. Then most pounds will allow you some time with the dog outside the cage. So if you have another dog, for instance, always bring that dog. Because dogs have to, like human beings, they have to. And some dogs are dog reactive. They don't like other dogs. They just don't. And some dogs are actually, they prefer other dogs more than humans. This is especially true for dogs which are scared, because they can communicate with another dog, which they cannot communicate with a human being. Bring your dog. If you have children, bring your children also. Also, when you're adopting from a pound, consider the energy level of the dog. And especially if you have small children, you may not want to adopt a dog like German Shepherd. You may not worry, because the problem with a German Shepherd is that, or a pit bull, for instance, is because their bite. If they bite you once, it's going to be a serious injury. You know, Chihuahuas are normally much more aggressive than any of these dogs. But Chihuahua, even if it bites you, it's a nip. It's nothing. So, you know, be careful about all these things. But I think if the most important thing is when you go to a pound, always look at the way the tail is. That is very important.
All right. That was your passion for dogs showed up because you, it was my favorite question as well. Now, moving on. I'm sorry, we spent 45 minutes avoiding 90s Bollywood, but you know, it's going to come sometime. So here it is. She wants to know your top five worst 90s movies that you have watched.
So again, I hesitate from saying something like this, because 90s movies, you can say all the 90s movies are worst movies and they're all the best movies. It's the fact is the genre. For me, if any 90s movies fits in to the genre, I wouldn't like to call it the worst. For instance, I wouldn't want to, I mean, from a purely aesthetic sense, may Prem Agan, bad movie, Gopi Kishan, bad movie. But if in the context of enjoying 90s movies, those are the archetypes of the 90s movies. So there's really no good answer to this worst 90s movie. Is Gunda the worst 90s movie or is it the best 90s movie? Who knows? The fact is, for me, there are no worst 90s movies because I enjoy all 90s movies. For me, worst is, you know, things which I don't enjoy. The movies of today, most of them, I don't enjoy. They would be my worst 90s movies, in a way. The Hindi movies of today.
We also had one more unknown person on WhatsApp asking me to ask you about blue tick celebrities that have blocked you. I'm not sure so, you want to take this one.
No. I've said I've been blocked by so many people. Sagarika Ghosh, Rajdeep Sardesai, Srishant, for God knows why. Okay, I know why, but there's some people who have blocked me, like Saina Nehwal has blocked me because I once made a joke about Saina and she was asking for, at that point, I was asking for some sports awards and I made some jokes, so she blocked me, which is fair. But there's some people who I don't even know what I have said, they have preemptively blocked me. So, you know, sometimes find I can't read somebody's tweets, and so if I find that this person is blocked, I don't even know who that person is and I've been blocked by that person. I don't even know who that person is. So it's always, and I've been blocked by Madhukishwar on the right also. So I've been blocked by, like, Sagarika goes on the left, Madhukishwar on the right, which shows that I'm in the right, I'm doing something right, so that all of these people are blocking me, which is again good to know. And some people, I mean, the person who I always expect that will block me but never does is Ashutosh, and thank you. Because Ashutosh is the guy who I've ribbed continuously for the last so many years, but he's never blocked me, and I, you know, thank you for that.
Okay, and Sunil Kumar wants to know about two books that you would recommend to yourself 15 years ago.
So I read this question and I couldn't think of any. I couldn't think of any two books. The only book that I could think of, especially because the question is very specific. I would put Man's Search for Meaning. I don't know if any of you have read it. It's written by a guy called Viktor Frankl. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. So he was actually a concentration camp survivor. And he wrote this book called Man's Search for Meaning. It's about essentially coping with grief. It's about coping with, you know, how do you cope with, you know, how do you stay alive? So this main question was, how did people stay alive during concentration camp when you lose all hope? And so he was a psychiatrist, and this is a scientific book. So this is not just guys is saying things. So there's some science behind this. It's a fascinating book. It's just a very insanely popular book. And I wish I had read this 15 years ago, because not that I agree with everything that it says, but I think it's very provocative in a very understated way. It kind of, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't read it, because the reason why is there's no twist in anything in this story, but it's very important that people interpret it as they want, rather than me telling them what I believe that book is and what it's trying to tell you. But I think that especially for the last few years, I've alluded to things, you know, that things haven't worked out for me in different spheres. And so I have kind of faced with, you know, grief of that level, not a small, not like KKR didn't win kind of grief. I'm not talking about that kind of grief, or, you know, those kinds of disappointments. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about, like, major stuff. And so this book, I wish I'd read 15 years ago, not because it would have fundamentally changed the way I would have dealt with grief, but I think it would have put some context to it. And again, the basic tenet of the book is that in order for you to cope with grief, the main thing is that you have to define some sort of purpose. You have to wake up every morning to say that this is the purpose for which I am alive. And that purpose could be anything. It could be your job. It could be a family. It could be anything. But that you have to have this attainable purpose, that I am alive because of this. And the moment people kind of forget what it is, that's when you know things start going south. So it's very important. That's why this Man's Search for Meaning, that title. And I would again recommend all of you to read this book, even if you haven't coped with grief or think that you will never do so. It's a great book. It's a difficult book to read. It's not an easy read in any sense of the term, but it's definitely a book which I wished I had read 15 years ago when I was much younger.
For me, honestly, I think there's only one right answer to this question: a book to give yourself 15 years ago. And the answer was given in Back to the Future, where Biff goes and he gets a sports almanac and gives it to his past self, who bets and makes a shit ton of money and becomes one of the richest guys. So that's probably the other angle to go with.
So that would then be Sachin Tendulkar's that biography, because it's a basically collection of scorecards of matches that will happen in the future.
Okay, then Avjit asks, you've addressed this in some parts, but Avjit Das wants to know if you have any plans to come back to India after retirement. And he says, I know that you tried to be back some time ago and it didn't work out.
No, I don't think if I haven't gone back to India by the time I'm retiring, if I'm alive till then, that is, I don't think that at that point of time I can come back to another country, because it would have been like ages since I had left India permanently. And the US would essentially be my home. And that, you know, the older you get, the more difficult it becomes for you to adjust psychologically, health-wise, I mean, your joints can't adjust in a way. So I think we become ossified, you know, internally and externally as every day goes by. And as it is, I kind of feel that I'm kind of getting to that stage where I don't think that I'm already too set in my ways. But definitely after retirement, I don't think that I would want to leave, you know, where I am at that point of time. Just be, I mean, one of the things that people don't realize is so key to happiness is essentially the mundane details of life. It's just waking up and knowing that you're going to do the exact same thing that you did last day. And especially when you retire, I think that regularity, that's why you find old people are so obsessed with their stool and the passing of their stool.
Because I was thinking
if
of
you
the
don't
exact
pass
same thing.
The right way, and I'm, you might think I'm joking here, but I'm kind of, but I'm also not. But if you grow old, you'll find that if you don't pass stool at the right time, that kind of screws up your entire day. You feel it entire day, and it kind of messes with you because everything is now off now because of that fact that either you didn't pass stool or you didn't pass the amount of stool that you expected to pass. That's why you find old people obsessively talking about stool in the same way teenagers talk about the opposite gender, because this is really what drives their whole life. So just like, you know, when you're young, you think of the opposite gender every 30 seconds or something that I once heard of. It's not me, of course. But so when you grow older and when you retire, it's you, every 30 seconds you think of your stool and, you know, how you're passing motion. So again, and at that stage of my life, and I've seen old people, so I've seen them do this, I don't think that I would want to go to India and, you know, kind of totally screw up my schedule. I at that point of time, my schedule will be my happiness. That will really be, to come back to the last question, my meaning, to make sure that I live my next day in the exact same way that I lived my previous day, and I'm alive at the end of the next day. That will be my goal.
Okay. And Mawsam asks, if you've seen the Dave Chappelle special on Netflix, I assume you haven't. You said you're not a big fan of stand-up. But then he goes on to ask about your views on too much of political correctness, which is shrinking the stand-up space.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I totally agree with Dave Chappelle. And I think the reaction that Dave Chappelle's show got was instructive. I mean, when Dave Chappelle first came on to the American public consciousness, he was like, these same guys were like his hugest, biggest supporters, because he was basically taking that exact same shtick that he now has and was turning it on punching down versus punching up. So at that point of time, he was considered to be punching up, so he was a hero. Now, since he is rich and now he's part of the mainstream, when he does the exact same shtick, he's now punching down. So effectively, the content, you know, if either you found Dave Chappelle, and Dave Chappelle is an acquired taste, and it's not for everyone, but either if you found Dave Chappelle funny, then you should definitely find Dave Chappelle funny now, because he's the exactly same guy. It's just that people are shocked that he's going after targets which are not supposed to be gone after. And I've always said that, you know, that stand up, you know, this is not, I mean, stand up and university, there are certain places in which you should have safe space for expressing opinions which are unpopular. And by being a part of that, you essentially express your consent to listen. But unfortunately, in this day and age, millennials are always, they don't want to be triggered. They're afraid that they'll be triggered. Anything that people say, this comes with a trigger warning. Dude, living world is, I mean, this is the height of self, you know, being self-absorbed. Of course, the world is supposed to trigger you. That's what being alive is. The only person who's not triggered is dead, is a corpse. So taking stimuli from the environment essentially means triggering. However, there's nothing we can do. The world is as it is. But at least there should be some spaces left where you can, you by walking into that space, you implicitly consent to being triggered. And one of the places is an university, which should be in a place for free exchange of ideas, which can be radical. That's why I am absolutely against, like, this whole, you know, anti-nationalism, these narratives in the university. I think in university is a safe space. You should be allowed to say what you want to say in a university, short of like, let's go and kill people. Not that. But the bar for free speech should be higher in a university. It should be higher in stand-up comedy. And people say, but we're not preventing you from doing it. We're mainly passing judgment on you. Which is, again, a valid point. But unfortunately, what happens is that with social media and with the avalanche, and this is, again, a point that Dave Tivell brought up, is that you feel intimidated and threatened by this whole cancel culture. So it's not that people are just criticizing you en masse, which you can argue that they have the right to do, but it's also that they're trying to make sure that you are deplatformed. That is the subtext, and that's what Dave Chappelle is saying in this show, and that's what many in America now call the cancel culture. And for those of you who listen to this podcast, I've talked about this many times before, that, and this might be new to the US, but it's absolutely perfectly, you know, we are very well aware of this in India, where certain sections of thought has been deplatformed consistently by those that own the platforms. So there's nothing wrong. There's nothing new about this. But yes, it has not been social media driven for so long. It has more been driven by those that are in power. But in India, since we follow everything in the US, that thing remains. But we're also now being driven by social media outrage and then that cancel culture. And some people say it's good. I don't think so. And I like the Chappelle stand-up for that.
Okay. Hey, good, good. We'll wrap up with two quick ones. One, of course, we've not spoken about cricket. So the Kaushik theory asks you, Lara versus Tendulkar, the better batsman. And no diplomatic answers, please.
I think Sachin Tendulkar is the better batsman. For me, it's not a question of being diplomatic. The whole thing that Lara wins matches and stuff, Tendulkar's staying power, the amount of staying power that he had, the kind of domination he had over, you know, two forms of cricket, I don't think Lara had that form of domination. You could argue that he was, Lara played in a weak team, and so did Sachin Tendulkar play in a weak team. But I think the impact that Tendulkar had is way exceeds that of Lara. Of course, Lara is a very attractive batsman to watch. But honestly, I would definitely say that Tendulkar would always, in my mind, be above Lara.
Okay, and finally, we've got this question which just came in from Baba Jetadhari. And he wants to know, what did you think of Gully Boy's India's entry to the Oscars?
So, Gully Boy, you know, it's of course, I would say it's a good entry into the Oscars. I'm going to go against, I haven't seen Gully Boy. And this has nothing to do with the quality of Gully Boy. I'm pretty sure it's a happy movie based on the director. And based on what I've seen, I mean, it's a total dip-off of 8 Mile in terms of, you know, the whole thing. Based on what I've seen in the trailers, it's so reminiscent of 8 Mile. However, you see, winning Oscars is not about good movies. Okay, so if you send Super Deluxe, for instance, which I'm pretty sure is a much better movie, it's just going to leave the Oscar, it's going to leave the Oscar jury cold. So the Oscar jury wants to see one thing. It wants to see slum dogs. Okay, it seems Slumdog Millionaires. It wants to see something set in the slums. Boom, take number one. Okay, satisfied. Secondly, it wants to see something which it can understand. So even with everything that they want to say, ultimately the American Oscars always gravitate towards familiar themes. And so the very fact that this is like 8 Mile is not really a bad thing for Oscars. This is going to be way more familiar to them than the inherent weirdness, let's say, of Super Deluxe, even though it might be a better movie. So this whole thing that it's not a great movie doesn't really matter. Oscars is not, I wouldn't say it's never been, but over the last 20 years at least, it's not been about great movies at all. It's been about movies which satisfy certain requirements. And I think that of the movies that I can think of, I think Gully Boy actually satisfied most of those requirements.
All right. So do you have any plans? I think it's available on Amazon Prime. Might want to catch it.
I have no plans to see that. This is not my stuff.
Not your stuff. So I think that's pretty much our podcast for today. And wow, I'm going to have a tough time annotating the timestamps. You've answered what? How many topics? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 different topics. So, okay, I'm going to need some time off just to process all of this. So in case to our listeners, if you have left out any of your questions, apologies, I've been keeping track of Twitter.
Okay,
but
so let me read two questions that just came.
Sure, yeah.
So Rishu Malhotra says, sometimes the nostalgia hits hard. The ones from the 1990s, how do you deal with it? By embracing it or by finding solace in the 21st century? No, I don't find solace in the 21st century at all. I absolutely embrace 1990s. I don't even try to move beyond it. And Abhishek Das, what songs do you listen to on a Sunday evening? What is the memory attached to those songs? And this is, you know, how this is a, there's a book answer.
That's like breaking. I think this question just came in. So good for Abhishek.
Okay. So thanks everybody for tuning in. And and again, I'd like to mention the fact that any sponsorship for this show, that beginning thing, doesn't go to me. So it's not me. For me, it's the Patreon page. That's it.
Absolutely. That's Great Bong. Patreon.com/GreatBong.
Yes. So if you want to support this podcast, please go to Patreon, to my Patreon page. And thanks a lot.
Thanks, and see you next time. Take care.